This interview has been conducted for the Making History, the Discipline in Perspective project, and the project officer Danny Millen will be speaking to Susan Reynolds about her experience of and views on changes in the discipline and academic profession of history. Susan, would you be able to give a brief biographical background of yourself for us?
Right. Well, I immediately after taking my first degree at Oxford, I trained as an archivist and went into archives. I worked as an archivist at Middlesex County Record Office for a year, and then I went into the Victoria County History, where I worked for 7 years. And between the archive training and the VCH was really the equivalent of my PhD. It was my training. I haven't got a PhD. I haven't even got an MA in history, though I've got a diploma in archive administration. And working for the VCH was fun, but then I didn't want to do it all my life, and I thought I wanted to do teaching, so I went and taught in school, first of all in secondary modern school, which was very educational for two terms, and then in a girls' independent school, where at first I felt I was going to fall forward because there was sort of so little coming at me, as there had been in the secondary modern, but I enjoyed that a lot, and I wouldn't have moved into university teaching if it hadn't been suggested to me. And this, I think, is actually quite an interesting story, because I must have been one of the last people appointed to a university job through an old girl network. This was the winter of 63-64,
right,
when there had been a lot of new universities just opened. And my predecessor, who had been my tutor, teaching medieval history at Lady Margaret Hall, was going to retire. And there weren't many women about. They had to have a woman, you see, to be a fellow of a women's college.
Right.
And women, on the whole, didn't do so much postgraduate work. And if they did, they tended to be married and having babies. And they were not very mobile, or indeed employable full-time, or didn't want to be employed full-time. And so I got this letter, a manuscript letter, from the principal of my own college, where I had not got a first, I may say, but I had kept a little bit in touch.
Mm-hmm.
And this manuscript letter said, "Dear Miss Reynolds, Miss Hernard is retiring," or words to that effect, who was my predecessor, "and we wondered if you'll come to lunch one Sunday." So I went to lunch, and it was extraordinary. I mean, some people... Oh, yes, before I went to see the principal, I went to see the other history tutor, who had rung me up and told me I was to come and see her first. And she then kept saying, "Well, you'll be teaching this, and I'll be teaching that." And I was a bit sort of flummoxed. And then I went to see the principal, and three other people came in to have drinks before lunch. They were the selection committee, for goodness sake. And that was all that happened. And after about a month, actually, I was a bit worried. What was happening? Was I going to be summoned for an interview? And I'd already consulted my ex-boss and friends, and I wasn't sure I wanted to do this. Mm-hmm. But it seemed crazy not to do something, to refuse a change if it was offered to you. And in the end, the delay was simply because they had to wait for the next meeting of the governing body and all that. But so anyway, that's how it landed up at LMH in Oxford. And I went into it very much for teaching. I enjoyed teaching a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I had actually more or less given up doing medieval history. I had been editing a text, which my ex-boss on VCH, well, while he was still my boss, put me onto. He was very determined that his assistants should be improving their careers, and made me edit a text in evenings.
And who was your boss at the time?
This was Ralph Pugh, who was a bit of a character, but he was a very good boss. He was very benevolent, and he quarrelled with people a bit, but if you treated him straight, he was fine. I learned a lot from him. But I'd more or less finished that text, finally, and I thought I might toy with some 19th century history, because medieval history is very unsuitable to do in evenings, because, you know, all the sort of medieval history I was thinking of, sort of with documents and so on. So I'd really given up medieval history, so I had to take it up again. And I decided I'd do something on urban history, medieval urban history, because that linked up with my local history. Barbara Harvey of Somerville was wonderful. She gave me lists of essays, topics to set, and books to read. And during that summer I worked very hard, but I was pretty ignorant.
And that was in preparation for your teaching?
That was for teaching, that's right. It was the teaching that really preoccupied me. And the first year or so I was pretty ignorant, but I gradually sort of accumulated knowledge. And meanwhile, I got keener and keener on research, so that after, well, by about 20 years there, I was getting a bit stale, partly because I was more and more interested in the research, and therefore spending less and less time on doing new things in teaching. So the teaching got staler.
And that was by the early 80s?
That's by the early 80s. And so then I decided to leave a bit early. It was really because an American friend who did medieval history, who had stayed in my London flat, not this one, but that was mine, while I was in Oxford once, he had got a whole year's leave coming up from his job at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire.
Right.
He thought it'd be nice for him and his wife to spend the year in London. So he had to get rid of me, as it were. So, because I had always had a flat in London that I occupied in vacations, which I found worked very well, really, because I liked the British, I liked the IHR and the British Library more than Bodley and so on. Anyway, so he asked me to go and do his teaching for a year at Dartmouth. Now, I wasn't entitled to leave because I'd quite recently had some. So I decided to leave. I was, at that stage, I was 58, so I had to do two and a half years, or I suppose I was 57. Anyway, I had to do 2.5 years with that before I could get a pension, and it wouldn't be such a big pension. But you see, I'm single.
Mm-hmm.
And my first year, I was paid at Dartmouth, and then I just had a small gap. So that was fascinating, Dartmouth. I really loved it. It was an awful waste to accumulate the knowledge for teaching there in a quite different system for just 1 year and then be retiring. But never mind, it was great. So then, after that, that was 86 I left Oxford, 87 I stopped teaching at Dartmouth. So I've actually been retired for as long as I was teaching.
But retired, I suppose, as...
Retired from gainful employment.
As many historians are,
yes,
from gainful employment, but not from...
That's right, because the chief reason why I retired. I was getting a bit stale, but I wanted to work on this subject of feudalism, which my friend Peggy Brown, who must count as one of the important figures in my field of research, who's American, she wrote this wonderful article in 1974 called The Tyranny of a Construct, Feudalism and Historians, just saying, what the hell do historians mean by this word? We did think at first we would write a joint book, but actually it was much better that we didn't, because we have different views about footnotes and all kinds of things.
So that would have made things complicated.
It would have made things complicated. And she was busy with other things. So I went ahead and wrote a book which simply concentrated on the two key aspects of non-Marxist feudalism, that is, fiefs and vassalage. And she read it all, and was gave me criticisms and so on, but I did it on my own. And that was really what I did for the first few years of my retirement, and then I went on from there. So that's, yes, I mean, the influences on me, I think, well, Ralph Pugh and the VCH, I suppose my original tutor, Naomi Hernard, and then looking at important figures, well, Peggy Brown, who started me on feudalism, was certainly important. But then I also got interested in the whole question of what people mean by nationalism.
Right.
And Anthony Smith, who is at LSE, who's a sociologist, I don't go for what he's written since, but he wrote one article in the early 70s, which I thought was brilliant, defining the ideas that lie underneath nationalism. After I retired and was living in London all the time, the early medieval seminar with Janet Nelson, John Gillingham, Michael Clancy, it was wonderful, it still is. So Janet Nelson, Jinty Nelson, is also a major... I don't know if you're going to talk to her.
That's someone who I'm hoping to speak to.
Yes, quite. Well, she's a splendid runner of a seminar, but also her history influences me a lot.
And are there any figures cast in your mind back further in the past?
Maitland.
Maitland?
Maitland, absolutely. I'm writing a little book on which he was completely wrong. It doesn't matter, you know, I think he was a frightfully good historian.
If he was completely wrong, could you still say that he's a...
Yes.
He's a good historian,
yes, this
if you
is,
like.
This was actually about a year before he died. He threw out in a letter to a friend the remark, "I have been wondering where the Americans got their eminent domain," which is what Americans call what we call compulsory purchase. It's called eminent domain.
Okay.
Americans. And he thought that this didn't exist in this country, and made three sort of sentences after that suggesting he didn't think it existed here and giving reasons about feudalism, why it didn't. And these were completely wrong. But, I mean, he was throwing out this idea in a letter to a friend, but if somebody had stopped and said to him, "What about railways and compulsory purchase?" he would have said, "Oh yes, of course." And my view of him is that he wouldn't mind being proved wrong. He'd be interested in new information.
It was the asking of the questions and
right.
the discourse
yes,
of
exactly.
ideas.
So, it was that remark, I think it was that remark, that started me on trying to write a history of expropriation for the public good. In other words, what we call compulsory purchase, or what Americans call eminent domain. He was wrong sometimes. And I get rather irritated. There are one or two medieval historians who keep trying to prove Maitland wrong. That's fine, you know, but I think it's sort of irrelevant. I think he was he had terrific historical imagination.
But maybe people who are more pedantic and are able to pick apart his arguments may not have that.
He was very pedantic. I mean, he worked very closely on documents and on a pretty narrow field most of the time, English medieval law. But he infused this imagination about how it worked and so on into it. So I think he was a very good thing.
And besides individuals, Would you be able to talk about any institutions or organisations that you think might have been important in the development of this field?
The Victoria County history is no longer really relevant to what I do now, because that was very nitty-gritty stuff, and now I do Great Claudia. But it was very important in training me. But the early medieval seminar at the IHR, I think, has been very important in my research since I started going to it from 1987.
And when did that come into being, that seminar?
Oh, years before. I think John Gillingham, he's a good person too to talk to. I think he thought that he had started it, and but it's always been run by a group of people, but I think he was one of the first, and Alan Brown, and then Jinty Nelson. But it was going before I got there, before I started going to it.
And so, and that was running at the IHR, obviously. Do you see the Institute as having played...
Oh, yes. And of course the VCH was in the is the Institute too. So I think the Institute is frightfully important. I've just finished being chair of the Friends, which I must say is a relief, because it's getting to be... I'm too old to be doing it, and it's getting to be hard work. But for about 6 years I've been chair of the Friends of the IHR, and I really think that is very important.
Mm-hmm.
I just hope they manage to raise the money to do the next bit of converting the building around, which I think is vital.
And do you think the importance lies in the seminars that are run?
I think it's the library primarily. This wonderful open access library. Of course, it's best on English history, but it's pretty good on sources for Europe too. Of course, it's most use on medieval history, because there's more in print.
Right.
Whereas for modern history, obviously, I think they've got a lot of reference works, and reference works, guides to archives and things. Mm-hmm. It is, I think it's vital, all open access. But at the moment, the trouble is that seminars are held in the library, so that people can't work in the library where seminars are going on. And I think it's absolutely vital that the next stage of conversion happens, when they're going to separate books from seminars, so that the seminar rooms will not have books in them, so that people coming in the evening, for instance, to work, can go on working, or can go on working anyway.
And there'll be a designated area for seminars.
Seminars are in separate rooms. And also, the other thing that they've got to do with the conversion is get it so that the desks are around the edge, so that they can be plugged into... Computers can be plugged in.
Of course.
Because that is something which at the moment they can't, mostly. So all these things are planned, but it's raising the money. Anyway.
As ever, it's all dependent on the finances, isn't it?
Quite, but that's getting off the point.
Maybe moving on to the next point I wanted to talk about. And again, looking at perhaps surveying the whole of the time that you've been occupied in the field of medieval history, what would you consider to be the major debates or points of contention in this area?
Well, there's the things that have sort of interested me, I suppose, feudalism, that's of which, you know, I have now come out, well, it's 13 years ago since I published this book. Some historians absolutely won't look at it, medieval historians, and others think it's reasonably sensible. What has hardly happened yet is anyone actually arguing with the evidence. There's been one person who's proved me wrong on something, which is fine, knowledge is advanced. But that feudalism is certainly important.
So that's that book is Fiefs and Vassals.
That's Fiefs and Vassals. And I've written some articles and bits since. My other interest in nation, what people mean by nations, and what historians mean by nations, and what people at the time meant by the various words they used. Mm-hmm. That suffers dreadfully from teleology. People always think of the nations that there are now as the real nations, and everything is leading to them, and I argue about that. And that goes on. And then there's law, which I'm always been interested in and I'm more closing down on, really, because I thought I wouldn't write another book after Fiefs and Vassals because it was too exhausting, and my memory is getting so bad and I get so tired. And this expropriation for the public good was not meant to be a book.
Right.
But it got a bit big, and so it's going to be a short book, which I hope will be published in the USA. Law is what I'm more focusing on now, because I can do little bits. That suffers from teleology too, very badly. I mean, lawyers are always looking for the origin of present procedures and ideas, which is a bit distorting. They don't make them. I think those were the things I thought about.
And perhaps a suggestion. Do you think, again, kind of surveying the period in the field as a whole, that there has been a move from a more strict constitutional political history towards a broadening of the subject?
Yes. Yes, of course.
For instance, when you started teaching in the early 1960s was presumably a time
we did more. Yes, that's of course that's sort of one of the troubles about teaching as it was there at Oxford then. You were left pretty free, but the Oxford system involved a board of examiners who were not the people who had been teaching.
Right.
I mean, some of them were, but if... So that different tutors were teaching different ways, and you had to cover topics which would enable your students to answer enough questions. So that, in a way, it was subject to tutorial decision. And there was quite a big choice of questions, but it was much better if you stuck to fairly obvious themes, which were obvious also because they often had quite a lot written in a controversial way, which gave the students a chance to argue.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of questions which were thought of as old war horses were often awfully good questions to get people thinking. But it was more old-fashioned narrative, politics, the church, and so on. But it was... I've been retired for too long to know enough about people teaching now.
Right, but did you notice over the 20 years you were teaching there, the kind of subjects that became... acceptable to be assessed in examinations, for instance,
I don't think so, because there were always quite a lot of questions on the papers.
Mm-hmm.
So that there was always the more fancy subjects came in too, as it were. There wasn't a big change, I think. Not
That's
while
interesting.
I was there. There may have been a change in some of the questions. I mean, there was certainly a change in some of the questions, but not a total revolution. But I think that in a way people got quite a good training in arguing, and so on, about taking a question and trying to solve it, problem-centred work, mm-hmm. rather than meditations, as it were.
And you were... You'd mentioned, I think, when we were corresponding about this interview, about your obsession with historical method.
Yeah, oh, did I? Yes.
In fact, I think you said you wanted to sound off about your obsession.
Well, I do get rather worried. I think that historians are not interested enough in historical method. And how you prove something or don't prove it, sort of Popper and Karl Popper, sort of disproving things and so on. I remember at one stage I got very fussed about this, and I kept saying, you know, I couldn't find anything to read on historical reasoning, and people kept
putting, kind of historical equivalent of Popper's.
Yes, that's right. Just reasoning in general, more widely in general. And people kept saying, oh, there's this book or that article, and they were always about the philosophy of history. But that's quite different. Mm-hmm. That's about causation. And what I was interested in was historians thinking harder about what they're doing. You could call it theory, but I wouldn't want to sort of go into what theory is considered mm-hmm. now. But, I mean, one of the things, for instance, I found is that people are not really interested enough in the words they use and what they mean. Oh, Susan, there you go, about words. Mm-hmm. You know. But it isn't the words, it's the concepts behind them that are in your head when you say the word, and then there's the relationship to the actual thing out there that you're describing.
That there are almost two meanings of words.
Three. There's the word, the concept, and the phenomenon. I've got a little diagram of that, actually, which is quite good. But if you take the word chair, that's a hideous one, it can also mean a professor's job. Mm-hmm. And we sort to take for granted, or if I say, are there any tables in your book, you don't get worried that I'm talking about a table. You know what I mean. But in fact, I could be thinking about different things. So there's the word, which is, of course, different in different languages and changes its meaning, and the person hearing doesn't always have the same concept in their mind as the person talking. There's the word and the concept, and then there's the physical thing.
So assuming the meaning of such a word when it's in an 11th century source, would suggest it's a dangerous thing to do.
Well, historians, for exactly that reason, that's right, tend to want to give Latin words, medieval Latin words, defined meanings, fixed meanings. Mm-hmm. Feodum, fief, you know, meant this. Well, it meant lots of different things. As if you start to read the documents, it's used in different contexts and presumably meant referred to different rights and obligations in different circumstances, but people don't like doing that enough. And I do find, this is very petty, but there are some things which reveal the lack of interest in exact meaning. For instance, people often refer to assuming something or assumptions when they mean arguments.
Right.
There's an important distinction, it seems to me, between arguing something and assuming it.
Yes.
I've been cross with colleagues who said that I assumed something when it was something I was arguing about. And then there's the word refute, which is not the same as deny. Refute means you do it successfully.
Right, that's...
You know, and these little things like that, they are very petty, but they reveal this lack of interest in the processes of reasoning and so on.
And do you think that that lack of interest has been maintained, or do you think there's been a change?
No, I think it's maintained pretty well. I don't think, and in fact, to some extent, it may have got, well, in some ways I think people are beginning to think about things like that, or some people are more, but in other ways the pressure to publish works against that, and also the pressure to be popular. The distinction between academic and popular history is really difficult. I think that some people do get infected by popular history, not to the extent of actually explaining all the words they use, which would be really useful, and writing short, clear books, but just, well, for instance, using the historic present all the time.
Right.
James the First comes south in whatever, I can't remember, 1603. I don't remember that. But, but you know, this thing about talking, Thursday morning is Malcolm Bragg, Melvin Bragg.
Yeah.
And, you know, those people talking about history, there was one this morning who didn't use the historic present. But I turned off the radio before I could discover who she was. I just had it on briefly. But this sort of thing of slightly sloppy writing and using the historic present, which means I'm so close to it. It's so close to us. It's so immediate. Well, this is not true. They were not us. We are not close to them. And I get worried by that. And professional historians have started to do it.
So you think that's an infection from
an
popular
infection
history?
From popular, but they're not. It seems to me that the real things that popular history needs is sort of clarity. And it needn't be just giving one side of the story or just narrative. You can make things, people interested in problems. Actually, my first book, I think, which was about English medieval towns, I go on getting little bits of money for people using that.
Which is an indication of enduring
popularity. And I think I tried to make that clear, and I tried to explain words, and I do, and I found when I've talked to people, there was one early article I wrote. I didn't usually start writing, publishing, except on the PCH until late, but my first article was about forged charters. And in fact, it's very technical, but I found that you could use it. I can use it talking to non-professional groups, and they quite like it generally. They can understand it, and I think popular history doesn't need to be simple. Well, it needs to be clarified and kept short, simplified a bit, but not with all the problems taken out. I think people like problems. Look at detective stories.
Exactly.
And some people, of course, do this beautifully. But it's rather surprising, I think. I'm trying to think of really good examples of I now can't, of course, think of anything.
Of popular history in
popular history that really works well. But there's some things which are not officially popular history are, in fact, readable and clear.
And again, do you see this as being a change, say, from so-called popular histories that might have been around in the 60s and 70s, do you think?
I think it's a change in the academic history, in a way.
Right.
That people have tried to become more popular, but haven't always done it in the way that they could have, of clarifying, proper indexes, proper maps, proper genealogical tables. I mean, it is amazing how people don't do that. And also keeping books short, I think, is vital. And I think that some academic historians who try to be more popular don't do those things. I mean, I've stopped trying to be popular. Anyway, the only thing I've ever written that was remotely popular was that first book. Though I think my second book, some people found comprehensible and others didn't.
So you've gradually got more unpopular.
I suppose I have, really. And by the time it comes to eminent domain expectation, well, I don't know.
So, okay. Well, maybe we can move back to a more a general focus now.
Yes.
I was wondering if I could ask you your opinion on how you think the pressures on academics have changed during your career or lifetime.
Yeah. Pressures to publish.
Right.
And for people teaching, the numbers of people to teach and everything has increased. I mean, I left the profession, you see, in 86, which is just when it was beginning to get tough. They're less tough in Oxford than elsewhere, but everywhere. And I see...
That's the beginning of the RAE and just before the expansion of the
universities. It was before the RAE, but when money was clamping down. And I know from my friends and colleagues in the seminar and around that it is much tougher now, and they had to teach more students without more books or even necessarily more rooms. So that there's that, and also the pressure to publish.
Right.
Which really didn't exist while I was teaching in Oxford.
But at the time, had you not published anything at all, that would have not have impaired your career, so to speak? Or...
Well, once I got appointed, I was secure. Unless I behaved badly. You know. I think that what did happen, actually, was that people who didn't publish at all cut less ice in the faculty, in the history of the faculty in Oxford, by the time I was leaving, or even earlier than that. And I think that applies generally. And it's very unfair, because there are some people who teach very well and who have a certain local sort of reputation as good teachers, but it doesn't work outside. They're not anybody. And that chain has become more and more so, I think. But... while I was still teaching, I did, in fact, publish. It took me a bit of time to get going, because I had so much to learn. But I published more than I didn't absolutely need to publish.
Right.
In order to keep my job. And there just wasn't any promotion, really, that I wanted or needed. It would have... So that didn't arise for me, but it certainly arises now, the RAE.
And I guess a connected question to that is the relationship between teaching and research.
Right.
Do you see that as changing over that period?
Yeah. Teaching has got much more professional, I think. It was awfully amateurish, well, particularly in Oxford, which includes the good side of amateur, people taking a lot of trouble over their students. Not that they didn't have to.
Yeah.
But they did. Some did and some didn't. I mean, it was very amateur in that way. And the sort of way you gave out lists of books. When I was an undergraduate in the late 40s, the list of books to read for my next essay were just dictated out loud. Including sort of names of authors, you know. You wrote them down madly on a little bit of paper, and they were all very garbled.
I suppose this is before the days of photocopiers and
their printers. That's right. And then I when I was doing it, I typed them and or got them done on a, what was it called, that machine? There was a system of copying, which I now can't remember the name of.
But again, before the photocopiers.
Before photocopiers. And then when photocopiers came in, I typed my own discs and photocopied them. But there was a stage before that. Anyway, and now, but also the whole pressure. And I think lecturing people, you see, gradually coming in before I left Oxford, was this idea that people starting off should be told how to lecture.
Right.
Which was a jolly good idea.
Particularly
if it's done at the beginning, before you...
Before you go out there and start making mistakes and...
Well, and it's terribly hurtful if you tell somebody they've been doing it all wrong.
When they've been doing it for 20 years.
Exactly. But I think it is very helpful to have that. And one thing and another, I think joining up the new universities, the ex-polys, was extremely helpful because they were much more professional about lecturing and teaching, I think, often, than universities were.
And so you think that subsequent to the joining up, I think it may have made a bit of influence. Right.
Though not much, but for the people who despise new universities. But you know, I think it helps. But I actually... I've heard of people. I remember hearing a story of somebody lecturing on the spread of settlement in the USA westwards, who talked about the Ohio Gap,
right,
and so on, without a map. British students. I mean, that used to go on, and people still, I think, are not professional enough. Even people who are up-to-date enough to use PowerPoint, mm-hmm, and then find some rotten little map which doesn't actually say quite the right thing to put up on their PowerPoint. But it is getting better.
In terms of, you mentioned the new universities and the merger of the polytechnics and the university sector. Do you see that as being something that's had a large change on the kind of university experience and the experience of teaching and researching history?
I wouldn't know. I mean, I've got some great friends who taught for years in what was a poly and did it extremely well, and I heard about things, and also were clearly very professional and efficient in what they did, but also took a lot of trouble about their students. But I think that it doesn't make an awful lot of odds between universities and ex-polys. I mean, there are some people who teach in very prestigious universities who aren't much good, mm-hmm, and vice versa.
Yeah.
But I think there is, in the long run, I'm sure it must produce mutual influences, which I should have thought were good.
And in terms of the expansion of the number of people doing history, which has been an inevitable consequence.
Yeah, I know, that's difficult. I think the trouble is, I actually don't believe in the single subject degrees that are the rule in this country, and even in all universities, they're too much shaped by the old single subject degrees, and I think that this is not a way of giving a general education.
But this is a change that hasn't happened but should have done.
Should it? Yes. I mean, it's that everyone, certainly up to 18 and preferably at university, should, for instance, and maths, some sort of mathematical and science subject, and then also mix in a bit more. This is a first degree, is a first degree. And I think a general education is a general education. The idea that you teach people best by letting them do one subject in great depth. This is the standard thing that people say. The best general education is to do one subject. Well, that's because that's what they teach and they want to go on teaching it.
So there's a vested interest
there. There's a vested interest.
And that
languages, that's right, is absolutely desperate, thinking of the future of the discipline.
I was wondering, and you may be too far removed from this, I guess, now, but that ties into the teaching of history in schools.
Yes, well, languages is just desperate, but it goes in universities. I remember quite recently meeting a young man who had been doing a special subject on, I think, was modern France, possibly the French Revolution. Everything was in translation.
So all of his sources.
That's right. And he was thinking of going on and doing research degree. And I remember saying to him, in the summer, maybe you could go to France or do a really intensive course. I think our civilization, this country and the USA, are both so monoglot, it's appalling.
And do you think, would that have been different when you were taking your undergraduate degree?
There was more languages then, yes. Everyone had done Latin, everyone had done French, and some had done, a few had done other things.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't mean that people could actually chat in French, let alone, of course, Latin.
Though chatting in Latin probably wasn't
chatting in Latin is different, that's right. But they have died away. When comprehensives were started, there was this wonderful idea that with big schools you could have more specialists.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have all these options. And then they started to take the money away from them. So they couldn't.
And is there anything else, any other observations about the teaching in schools, and particularly the teaching of history that you...
Well, it isn't so much the teaching of history. I mean, then again, maths. I used to find that when I set an essay, which I always did, on economic history and the Black Death and things, mm-hmm. and prices, people, they didn't want to do that. They couldn't do that. But they could, actually, if you led them into it simply and mm-hmm. made little diagrams of... Well, I had a little diagram where you had a little pin man and then a loaf of bread and then a penny. You had three little men, three loaves of bread and three pennies, and you tried taking out one and seeing what it did to prices.
So, and
from each row. I mean, this sounds as if I'm saying that I was wonderful at it. I don't mean that. But I did find that a lot of people could do economic history and even get interested in it if they had been led into it. But they started off with virtually no maths.
Or perhaps that specialisation at an early stage where,
yes,
where people decide,
yes,
that they are humanities or arts,
that's
students,
right,
and not scientists.
I do think people should have to go on to 18 at least with more subjects.
So that was prevalent...
The IB.
The baccalaureate.
Yes, that does that.
And which there's been continual talk for some time,
that's
hasn't
right,
been about,
yeah,
introducing.
Right.
You mentioned economic history. Other people that I've spoken to have talked,
yeah,
about how that came into vogue and is now in decline.
That's right. People, it's very sad. I mean, there's... In fact, it's not as much in decline. There are some very good economic historians about.
Right.
And of course I'm talking about the Middle Ages mostly, but it did go over from economic to social. And there was a stage when people talked about economic and social as if they were the same.
Right.
And it was basically economic. And now they've dropped off the economic and it's social, but it's not always clear what they mean by that, though there's some very good social history is written, but it's much more social. I don't know what's happened to economic history. It's sad. But there's some goes on.
So you think some goes on, because I know that one of the manifestations of the so-called decline has been the closure of economic history departments.
That, of course, I never have thought that it was good having lots of different history departments. I'd rather have history,
mm-hmm.
in which there will be economic history. And things like Leicester, where they had local history and economic history and history, seem to me a mistake, because it does make a bit of difference, the people you associate with. I think it isn't necessarily true that if you close an economic history department, there's less economic history. It may be.
But that those economic historians
may be. It can get embraced into history. Just as I cannot approve of people being able to do medieval history on its own.
Right.
I think you ought to do a whiz through history, at least a bit. And I think some of the old-fashioned sort of political history teaching had the advantage that people got a sort of framework of dates.
In contrast to the more modular approach, if you like.
Yes, that's right. And I think that you would want people to finish a history degree who had heard both of Charlemagne and Bismarck, even if they had only heard of them,
mm-hmm.
could put them into the right centuries.
And that gives you a context.
Yes, that's right. Now, of course, one of the troubles also is that, and this goes back to languages, but also the traditions of national history departments and history teaching in different countries is generally very much attuned to that particular country.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, when you think about it, it makes sense. As soon as history became professional, about sort of 1900, it became more nationalised, national. In the 19th century, there were lots of people who ranged rather widely over Europe, medieval Europe, I'm talking,
right.
but also other periods, I think it applied to. But it was a bit superficial, maybe. They used chronicles rather than archive sources, but archive sources began to come in about the end of the 19th century, and they are, of course, always national.
Right.
And there's an awful lot of them.
So,
but I mean, each country has its national archive and its local archives, and people are set to do their postgraduate work on those things which are there.
And that automatically.
And they teach, and then they go on teaching on that. And it isn't just the English who are insular. I mean, I've got very interested, I haven't talked about this, about comparative history. I really am dotty about people comparing.
Comparing between countries.
Between countries. And the Germans do German history. The French do French history and see it as the whole of Europe. I think the English do English history, but don't exactly see it as all Europe, but see it as separate.
Right.
Which is a slightly different thing, but they all produce the same result of not looking beyond the country. And it, to some extent, it's inevitable because of the sources, and there are too many of them.
And
they're there.
And
then there are languages.
Right.
And a lot of people, when they start their undergraduate degrees, say, oh, they aren't going to be interested in English history. They want to do other countries. But if you do other countries, you can only do it at a very sort of A-level or sub-A-level way if you only read English.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to do something on Southeast Asia, there may be only one book.
But which...
in English, that you could get at.
So if you, as you say, if you're not prepared to learn these new skills, then you're inevitably, and you want to be a historian, you're inevitably going to be forced back to the
same
field
of study. That's right. And of course, yes, it's, you really need to start earlier, like the Dutch. I had, was once assisted by a young man who was only at an MA stage from the University of Amsterdam.
Right.
English was his, he had done, after that he'd done German, French, and then English.
Well, I bet
his English was still good. Fine. He had an English girlfriend, but even his written English wasn't bad, which is, yeah.
And so do you think, talking about the national histories, do you think, again, that's something that's remained constant since that period of professionalisation that you talked about?
It's very constant. It's very worrying. It sets in, actually, with the 12th, 13th century. Again, I'm concentrating on it. But after that, practically everything is about one country. The Carolingians did a lot for early Middle Ages because they cover such a lot of ground. So that the people up to the 12th century are much more international. At first, the Anglo-Saxonists didn't join in much, but they do now. But after that, it becomes increasingly separate. And this isn't because of national stereotypes in the sense of all Germans are like that. But all German historians may be like that because they've been trained in that discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And the same goes for French and English and Italian and so on.
And I suppose another question arising from that is, how do you see the practice of history in different countries that obviously you've said British historians tend to study Britain, French historians France, German historians Germany, but are there also different approaches and ways of doing history?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Incidentally, just in passing, British historians tend to study England.
Okay.
That's improved recently, particularly about the Middle Ages. There's this wonderful man, Rhys Davies, who died about a year or so ago, who started that. He was a Welsh historian, but he got everyone onto British history.
Right.
Sorry, your question was about...
I was just wondering about what you thought about different national approaches.
Oh, yes. Well... the French say that, you know, the death of that, they are not interested in political history, the Annales school and so on. But what this means often is that they are not interested in old-fashioned political narrative.
Right.
But actually, it's a great mistake not to study politics, because for the Middle Ages, you get at ideas and society and so on, often through sources which are about politics. I mean, the chronicles are writing about kings, and the documents are about government and law and so on. And you have to use those to do other things. Mm. And in fact, people do that. But there is a slight tendency to sheer away from it by doing things like laughter or death. Fancy subject, the body. You've got it, absolutely. Which are fine subjects, and I think it's a good idea to expand, but I don't think you can actually dispense with the other things. But the French are particularly into that.
The Germans?
Germans! One of the troubles about all the Civil War countries, but particularly Germany, I think, is that legal history is in law departments.
Right.
And it's quite separate from ordinary history, and this means it's much more like old-fashioned legal history was. In this country, legal history's got much more integrated with looking at the society around it, at least for the Middle Ages. But I think for the early modern thing, too, they do. And this does benefits both ways. I mean, you can't ignore law. seems to me.
And similarly, law and the lawyers can't ignore the wider historical circumstances.
Well, that's what I mean. You can't. Yes, exactly. And that's one trouble. And there's also questions about the structure of professions. In Germany, when you're writing a thesis, it has to be something that your supervisor will agree with.
Right.
And you go on being sort of under authority for longer. Some people break out, but it's quite difficult sometimes.
So the structure of the profession...
The structure of the profession is more rigid. And it is, of course, government control. It's, you're appointed by the Land government, the provincial government, as it were. Universities are more under governmental control. I don't know whether that really makes a difference or how much difference it makes, but it is more top-down,
right.
I think. Here, there are gangs, of course, you know, different groups with their ideas, but there are quite a lot of them. So that even if one lot of people disapproves of you, other people may approve of you.
Simply because the other lot disapproved,
well,
possibly.
That's right. But so that I think it's more open.
And again, is that something that you see as being constant since the professionalisation of the discipline?
I suspect so. But I'm talking without evidence.
I'm not
writing footnotes. And, you know, this is just sort of gossipy opinion, really.
But that's exactly what this is about.
Right.
And we've actually come through all of the questions that I wanted to ask you.
Yeah, right.
So the only question was the dreaded one about the future of the discipline.
Yes, that's right.
Which I didn't know whether you felt like speculating upon.
I mean, I think in this country, unless languages get better, that's fatal. I hope people will become more comparative, more interested in making comparisons. But unless they learn languages, it's so difficult.
So you hope but don't necessarily expect.
That's right. But I think it's vital. And I think that, yes, comparison is vital. If you find that in your bit of history A needs to B, you assume that it always does.
Mm-hmm.
But if you immediately look somewhere else, you find that A leads to C or to X.
You question the universality of your conclusions.
It's the connections that you... That's right. That you see. And then it sends you back to looking to why B... it came after A, but it wasn't necessarily because of A. It leads you into more ideas about your own subject. And even two-way comparisons. People sometimes do comparisons with bits of France. Well, actually, in this country, the continent means northwest France. You know, things were different on the continent. In the continent, you discover they're citing something. This is for the Middle Ages, about northwest France. But never mind. But just comparing two things leads you to suppose that it's either or. As soon as you get three, it opens it up.
And the possibility of things being more contingent...
That's right.
Occurs more, I suppose.
Yes, yes. But comparisons, I think comparisons are vital for history. But they are very hard work. I mean, I've become comparative. Well, this book, Kingdoms and Communities, was my second book, and that I didn't read nearly enough. But some people think like it better than Fiefs and Vassals, which is a very tedious book. But those two, you know, I got more and more interested in looking at different countries. And I think it's important. But I don't know about the future of the discipline. I do wish that it didn't have to be just history on its own for undergraduates. I think it would be better if they went on to specialise. I mean, this is where, for instance, American system is rather good, I think, that the first degree is often mixed subjects and may even compel you to have things like one language and one maths or something, or one
That's
science.
Right, things that to us seem incongruous.
That's almost. Right, and then they take much longer and do much more serious teaching at the postgraduate stage. Mind you, I don't think it actually ends up with them speaking languages any better, but, well, it does some. I mean, some who decide to go into Italian history or French history or something, they get into that. But I do think that it produces a better educated person for general purposes. And after all, most people who do history as undergraduates are not going to be historians.
That's right.
They're going to do jobs outside. And one of the things, actually, one of the few things that does seem to me relevant from a history degree to people who are going to work in all kinds of other things is sometimes having to do an exam on the day required, or even write an essay on the day required. That's what your boss is going to ask. You turn up and you do it. Good
although
or
I suppose,
bad.
Although I suppose that would apply to any subject in a sentence, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. That exactly so. But that's one of the things that you learn on a first degree, to do things to time when wanted. And also maybe to express yourself, to write things down and know how to do it and all that. But it's allowing people too much freedom to do just what they want and are interested in is not a very good training for what they're actually going to do afterwards.
Tends not to happen too much in the world of work, does it?
It doesn't much.
Sadly.
It doesn't much, that's right.